So it's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks, Jean-François. I will tell you about O Genesis, life and death in the gonad. And we'll get to what these words mean, and I'll introduce the organ that we'll talk about in due time. So I thought it would be appropriate to start the presentation with a book that was already mentioned, which is Darcy Thompson's book from 1917 on growth and form, which is, as we've heard from Jean-François, one of, you know, probably the first reference, complete discussion of morphogenesis, and in particular in relation to physical forces and mathematical principles that might underlie morphogenesis of living systems. Of course, when we come from the biology and think about how organisms develop, be it a nematode worm or a quail bird or a zebrafish, how they develop from a single egg, we are of course aware that there are developmental programs running. So if you open a biology textbook, you'll see that there's a host of developmental programs running, and we've also heard from them in the presentation before. For example, in the fruit fly, there is a famous patterning system that structures the organism. And the model is actually called the French flag model. So here's my second sentence in French. And you know what happens here is that at the tip of the fruit fly, there is a morphogen secreted. And the cells measure the local concentration. And depending on the local concentration, they make a developmental decision. If the concentration is high, they express a particular set of genes. If the concentration is in the medium range, they choose to express a different set of genes. And if it's low, yet another set of genes. So here, a local concentration gradient plus a readout determines the fate of cells, if you wish. The other types of models that are used to describe pattern formation and development fall into the classes of Turing patterns, which Jean-François has also introduced. So here, chemical species talk to each other. Okay, so in essence, they react with each other. They make decisions. They might activate each other or cross inhibit each other, and they do that over space. So basically, reactions plus diffusions. And you know, if cast in the proper form, can give rise to spontaneous pattern formation and symmetry breaking and the emergence of so-called Turing patterns. Okay. So this is just a short introduction, because the point I would like to make, and I think it's very clearly seen in the movie that I'm showing here, which is a movie from the Huiskin lab using a spin microscope. You see cell nuclei, you see basically 6 hours in the life of the zebrafish, and cell nuclei from different tissues are labeled with different colors. Okay, that's all you need to know. And the point I would like to make is that these models that I've introduced on the first two slides, they don't really capture even the simplest things of what the simplest aspects of what we're seeing here. The first thing that I see when I watch the movie is that this object, this early zebrafish embryo, turns from round to non-round. Okay. So of course, these models that I've introduced on the couple of slides, they don't explain shape. So if you look at a process like this, you see lots of motility, you see cells crawling, moving collectively. The whole embryo is establishing here its backbone, here its head, here its front eye lobes. This isn't just a chemical decision-making process. This is also a mechanical process. Okay. So, and if we think about morphogenesis, we need to combine mechanics, these mechanical processes, with the regulatory chemistry is what I'm going to call it, okay, with these biochemical pathways that somehow control maybe the mechanics, but of course this is a two-way feedback system. So in the end, a theory of morphogenesis should combine these two features. And of course, you know, if we look back at the original publication more than 100 years ago, there are many hints of that already present in this masterpiece. So we've been interested in this coupling between chemical processes and mechanical processes for a long time. And of course, this coupling is prevalent in most aspects of biology. If you look at the molecular scale, where you can have molecular motors that take fuel, that take a chemical fuel, they take ATP, hydrolyze ATP, take the free energy derived by the hydrolysis reaction, and they can convert that to mechanical work. We have cells where chemical processes can interact, signaling pathways can interact with mechanical processes in the cells, for example, to break symmetries and to establish cell polarity. And of course, the tissue scale, which is probably best visualized in the movie that I've just showed you from zebrafish. And we've been, our lab's been taking a kind of three-tiered approach. So we pursue experiments in biological systems. We perform theoretical analysis and build theoretical descriptions. And we also pursue a biophysical approach, for example, at the molecular scale, where we use optical tweezers to characterize molecular scale force generation. However, I won't talk about the molecular scale very much, except perhaps to introduce what the molecules do. And of course, here, the key entities are these so-called molecular motors, these machines, molecular machines that can convert chemical fuel to mechanical work. And the one that's most relevant for the movie, for the zebrafish movie that I showed you, is the one that I'm showing you here, which is basically myosin. It's the same myosin, essentially the same myosin that contracts your muscles, okay, which is why we've got Arnold Schwarzenegger here, okay. And this is the most amazing movie of all times, you know, at least my own personal favorite, which is a high-speed AFM movie of a single double-headed myosin molecule stepping along a helical actin filament. So you can see the helical pitch. So this is seven. This is recorded basically with a high-speed atomic force microscope where you really scan a substrate. This is scanning 7 times per second the whole frame, and you can see this molecular motor taking, you know, stepping along the filament much like we would step along the surface. Okay, so this mechanical activity amplified a million billion times, in the proper context, essentially drives morphogenesis as I've shown it in that one movie. And I could probably stop my talk here. No. So, exactly. So let's look at the cellular scale. Okay, at the cellular scale, these motor proteins don't walk in the void. They walk along a filament. These myosin motor proteins in particular, they form, together with filamentous actin, form the so-called actin-myosin cortical layer. And this is the link for the cell. This actin-myosin cortical layer, which sits just underneath the plasma membrane, essentially is a critical link between chemical signaling and mechanical processes inside the cell. Okay, so this structure looks like this. So here you have a plasma membrane, the lipid bilayer, that, you know, and this actin-myosin cortex essentially separates the plasma membrane from the cytoplasm. It's very thin, maybe 100 nanometers in height. If you rip off the membrane and you do fancy electron microscopy, you know, it looks like this. So it's a rather disordered meshwork of actin filaments, where there's also myosin motors that act as active crosslinkers, if you wish, that, you know, that walk along the filaments in response to consuming ATP. Okay, and this structure sets cell shape, drives active processes like cell division. And when we take our fanciest microscopes, this is a structured illumination turf microscope, this is what it looks like. This is maybe 10 microns across, 10, 15 microns across. These are three frames. These are a couple of frames, 1 second apart in time. And you can see essentially, I'm going to say almost every actin filament in red and all the myosin motor proteins, they form so-called myosin minifilaments in green here. And of course, we can now go ahead and track and try to, you know, segment movies like this, and we're doing that. But of course, the tricky part is to relate, you know, the activities of all these green myosin motor proteins to the larger scale activity, which is a slow flow. I want you to realize that this cortex is flowing over from the right to the left very slowly. Okay, so, and of course, to be able to connect that is important, to connect molecular scale activities, molecular scale force generation by these myosin motor proteins to activities at a larger, maybe at a mesoscale. And of course, to do this, we have been working with Frank Jülicher. I'll show you some slides. I'll get to that in a second. We've been pursuing the approach that Jean-François has also outlined, and which is to treat this material as a piece of active matter, as a thin layer of a basically self-contracting viscous fluid, where the forces that drive self-contraction come from a chemical fuel that's present. So it's an out of equilibrium fluid, ATP consumption by a molecular motor in this essentially two-dimensional film drive force generation at the molecular scale, which drive active stresses, which in turn can propel this material into motion on its own. Okay, and we've been interested for many years in characterizing exactly the types of forces, the types of stresses that are generated in such a thin film fluid. And we've been concerned with three types of forces at mesoscales that are generated: an isotropic tension, in essence by an isotropic meshwork of actomyosin. So this is basically captured in one-dimensional form in the force balance equation that I'm illustrating here, where active tension gradients drive flows against viscous dissipation and frictional losses. You can go to an actual big cell. And what we can do with this type of force balance equation is we can measure the amounts of molecular motors at a mesoscale and relate the densities of motors with the velocity, the field of motor density with the velocity field in a quantitative manner. So that's force generation in an essentially isotropic actomyosin meshwork. If you look at the surface of the cell, there's a particular point in time when the cortex becomes more organized, and that's during cytokinesis. And what probably many of you have heard of is that when a cell divides, it assembles an actomyosin ring around the periphery, and that ring contracts preferentially in the direction in which the filaments are aligned, generates the extra stresses that are necessary to develop an ingression, and that basically divides the cell. So that means that a cortex can also contract anisotropically, in particular when in the case of cell division, when there's a region with aligned filaments formed. And we've been investigating how shear flows in an actomyosin cortical layer couple to alignment and how this can drive ingressions. Okay? So this is basically generation of anisotropic active tension in a more ordered actomyosin cortex. And what we've been looking at for the past couple of years is perhaps a little bit more of a not so obvious activity, which relates to rotatory flows and torque generation. So under particular cases, actomyosin cortex can drive rotatory flows. And what I'm showing you here, I should have said that before, is the surface of a cell, the top surface of a large cell. It's a C. elegans zygote. We'll get to that in a couple of slides. And what you can see, this is a particular genetic perturbation. You can see now that this cortex is counter-rotating. Two halves are counter-rotating. And this is because the actomyosin cortical layer at larger scales is generating torques. There's a torque balance in two dimensions that we have to consider. And here now the myosin gradients drive flows orthogonal to the direction in which the concentration of myosins change. So this is interesting also from a point of view of physics, because what we're considering here is active chiral processes here at the molecular scale. I've shown you that these myosin motor proteins, they walk on a helical filament. Okay, so in proper arrangement, this can give rise to torques, active torques at a mesoscale, and rotatory flows that can contribute to left-right asymmetric morphogenetic processes. And we've been quite interested in that because, of course, it's been a major question that has excited both biologists and physicists alike for many years. You know, we are essentially bilaterally symmetric from the outside, but when you look inside, we're not. Okay, the heart's always on the left side. So what are the processes that break symmetries? Okay, that help a growing organism to differentiate between left and right. And again, it comes back to Louis Wolpert, who stated the famous F molecule hypothesis, which is that basically you need some molecular process that's left-right asymmetric, and that has to be amplified to larger scales. And he termed this an F molecule, a molecule that is left-right asymmetric that has a certain activity that's amplified. And of course, here we now have one. Okay, we've got actin filaments. We've got motor proteins that might spiral around the filaments, and if they're aligned in proper ways, this can break. This can generate torques and break left-right symmetry. So this actomyosin cortex is potentially one way by which an organism can establish left-right symmetry and perhaps even establish the left-right body axis. And what we could show is that exactly this movement in the nematode worm two things to say is that when we look at development of a C. elegans zygote from one cell to essentially a full-grown animal for the first couple of cell divisions, we see that there's two lineages. There's a somatic lineage and there's a germline lineage. And cell divisions for the somatic lineage all counter-rotate as the cell divides, whereas cell divisions for the germline lineage don't do so. And in particular, at the 4 to 6 cell stage, there's a certain set of cells that undergo a particular shift. This shift is driven by these rotatory flows, causes a 20-degree shift in two cells, and this essentially causes a left-right asymmetric cell-cell contact pattern, which, in fact, is the mechanism that breaks left-right symmetry for the body plan in the nematode worm. Okay, so this is essentially how left-right asymmetry from the molecular scale now is amplified up to the organismal scale. That's what we think. Okay. All right, so this was just a brief summary to tell you a little bit that it's not just about signaling and building patterns, but it's also about mechanics, in particular, in this case, of course, about generating torques and thinking about force and torque balances for large-scale morphogenetic movements. But what I thought I would do now for the remaining talk is focus on one question, which is oogenesis and C. elegans, which relates to the title of the presentation. And then if there's a little bit of time, I'll tell you about a story we've already completed. So this is ongoing work. If there's a little bit of time at the end, I'll tell you about a story we've completed, which is also at the tissue scale, but in another organism. All right, so this is about oogenesis. This is about how to make an oocyte. So all of you know that an oocyte is the egg that needs to be fertilized by the sperm to build a zygote, which develops into an embryo and into a full-blown organism. How do the oocytes develop? Okay, so we've gotten interested in this because there's, again, an interesting aspect that relates to mechanics that helps in a decision-making process. And it's a very important decision-making process between life and death. Okay. Okay, it's a bit dramatic, but I hope it's late in the day, so maybe we can have a bit of extra drama. Okay, so oogenesis is basically tissues making cells. Okay, so we can look at different systems, at the mouse, at Drosophila, at C. elegans. I'll show you how it looks like in particular. But what we have is usually a large supercellular structure. It's called a syncytium. It's basically not just one cell, but it's many cells that are connected. These cells typically undergo incomplete mitosis, and they leave an open canal. Okay, and what happens it's well studied, for example, in Drosophila, is that there's one cell that will become the future oocyte, and there's lots of other cells which are still connected to this oocyte, which contribute their cytoplasm. Okay, they're basically, producing material, they're producing proteins, they're sucking up nutrients from the outside somehow to make one large oocyte. So why does the oocyte have to be so large? Well, the oocyte is fertilized typically by a very small sperm. And after fertilization, this fertilized cell, this zygote, has to grow into an organism, often all on its own, not being able to be fed in any other way until at least part of development is through. So oocytes are typically large just in order to have all the capacity to build, to go through many, many cell divisions, okay, to build much of the organism independent of any external sources of nutrients and so forth. Okay, so that's why the cells have to become large. And this is, in essence, a mechanism by which cells become large, because these other cells, so-called nurse cells, they donate their cytoplasm into this oocyte structure. Same is true for mouse, humans. It's all very, there's many similarities in different systems. So there's two characterizing features here, really. It's collective growth, okay? So the oocytes grow. They grow at the expense of somebody else, of some other cells. And there's lots of cell death, lots of apoptosis in the germline as well. Okay, so it's a cells undergo programmed cell death often in the germline. So let's look at the worm. Okay, I should have told you this before, but this C. elegans is a well-studied biological model organism. It's about 0.5 millimeter long. It lives all over the planet in your flower pots at home, quite likely to have a couple of C. elegans worms. And it's nice to keep in the lab. It's transparent, good for imaging. You can freeze it. You can freeze everything, but you can thaw C. elegans and they still live. So it's been a useful model organism in biology for many years. So basically the worm is, in simple terms, it's a gonad and a gut. Okay, so there's a gut that goes from the mouth, from one tip to the other tip, and wrapped around it, these are the two big organs, is the gut and the gonad, which has two arms, which look like this. So this is basically one half, and you'll have a mirrored copy of the gonad over here, okay, of the second arm of the gonad. And what you have in the gonad is this one big syncytial structure where there's lots of cells. You see these hexagon-shaped cells all sitting next to each other. It looks very much like a tissue. It is a tissue, except that each one of these germ cells has a hole to an inner structure, okay? If we make a cut through the middle of this, you'll see all these germ cells with the red nuclei on the edges. Then you see an inner structure, which is called rachis, but it's just filled with cytoplasm. And each cell has an opening to the rachis, okay? And now, over here, there's a so-called proliferative zone. There's lots of mitosis going on. And there's a couple of stem cells that are just dividing, spitting out germ cells. And this is essentially a conveyor belt. They're just slowly moving over. And then there's this interesting zone where apoptosis happens. Lots of germ cells die. And other germ cells grow. And the ones that grow, they go around a turn, and they become huge. You see, there's a huge increase in volume. And these are then fertilized. C. elegans is a hermaphrodite, so first produces sperm and then produces oocyte. So there's sperms over here, they're parked in another organ. And then these oocytes are self-fertilized to make the eggs. Okay, so that's it about oogenesis. So cells grow from very small to very large in a large syncytial structure. Okay, here's just another cartoon of what that looks like. And it's been described before. It's discovered famously by the Priest Lab, maybe 15, 12 years ago. The gonad is also, this prominent flows observed in the gonad. So what we're looking at here is just actin filaments. Actin filaments are everywhere. They're most prominent, of course, on the surface of the cell, but they're also sometimes prevalent inside. So we just use them as fiducial markers for flows. And I hope you can see here that there's a flux of cytoplasm through this inner rachis structure. You see the flow speeds up, and especially in this region around the bend, the flow even goes into the individual oocytes. You'll see a fertilization event here, I think. Here, this egg just became fertilized, okay? All right. So there's a 20-fold, there's lots of flows of material. There's a roughly 20-fold growth of volume, and about half of the cells die in this apoptotic zone. Okay, so we got interested in this because even though this is the system, C. elegans, this is the system where the cell death genes were discovered. Okay, so this is essentially not just in this case, but also in other cases in development. But this is the system where cell death genes were discovered. But even though the genes were discovered here, it's still not clear what triggers cell death. What process decides who lives and who dies here? Okay, it's a checkpoint mechanism. So if you take laser light or you add a chemical substance and you mutagenize the DNA, the cells are much more likely to undergo apoptosis. But under normal conditions, all the cells seem equally healthy, yet about half of them die. What's the process that selects which ones are destined to die and which ones will live? That's what we were interested in. All right, so to start this project, we thought it's probably best just to quantify as much about it as we can. So we measured sizes, lengths. So this is just a movie that shows you what this rachis structure looks like. Just to illustrate, this PhD student went a bit crazy with Imaris, okay? But you can go inside the rachis. You see that's a tube, inner tube. You see all the holes here, two of the germ cells. Hundreds of germ cells, each having a roughly equally sized hole. Okay? So we measured the volumes of all the germ cells, and this is just, you know, quantifying the volumes, where the color indicates cell volume. So you see they're small here, they get brighter here, and then in this apoptotic zone, you know, the colors jump around. So if we now, you know, introduce an axis which goes from the distal tip to this turn, okay, from 0% to 100%, we'll just investigate the system up to the turn. It gets too complicated with the turn. Okay, and what I'm plotting you here is from, I think, about 10 worms, the sizes of individual germ cells, so the volumes of individual germ cells in cubic microns or femtoliters. Okay? So this is an interesting axis because, of course, it's space, but it's also time. Because as I told you, over here there's the proliferative zone, so all the germ cells effectively move along as they mature along the gonad. Okay? So germ cells will start with a rather small volume, then collectively grow. And what I want you to realize from this is, of course, that at some point, this distribution splits up into two, close to the turn, and some germ cells grow and live, and other ones shrink and die. When they die, they are taken up by shell cells that surround the gonad, a muscle layer, and so-called smooth muscle cells. They're called sheath cells. And you can see it here for one cell. They engulf these small germ cells, and then they just pock them off, okay, and remove them. And they do this in response to apoptotic signals that are present at the surface of the cells. Okay, and this has been well studied by a couple of labs. All right, so obviously, if the germ cells over here start to increase in volume, as you can see, the volume has to come from somewhere. And if there's one thing that we know, is that this is essentially cytoplasm, cytosol inside of a cell. It's essentially water. It's basically incompressible. And here's the apoptotic zone. Here there's flows. These germ cells probably donate cytoplasm into the rachis. So how does this all work? Can we build a mechanical model for the hydraulics, the hydrodynamics of germ cell growth? This is what we asked ourselves. And of course, motivated by the one thing that we do know about the system, which is that, well, this was the question, what causes cells to grow or shrink in this region? That was, you know, if there's anything we know from about the system is that if there's flows, that there's pressure gradients driving these flows. Okay, and as soon as we started quantifying and saw this, we became quite excited because, and we're going to do an experiment now. Because maybe this mechanism here is not so different from something that you might know, which is that, you know, over here these germ cells become pumped. But if you pump a couple of germ cells that are connected, you might not be able to inflate all of them at once. Okay, to illustrate this, I've brought this device, okay, which is a T-piece and two balloons. And if you blow into this, you'll see that, of course, I will only be able to inflate one of the two balloons. You can't inflate both balloons at once. Okay, we're going to do this right now. It always works, I hope. So you see, so one increases, the other one doesn't. Okay, and that's, of course, because one gives. There's a pressure that is set up in response to the extension of the surface area. And, you know, and once one balloon starts to inflate, it's easier to increase the volume of that balloon in comparison to the other one. Okay, this is a great tool for a talk. All right. Okay. So we thought, well, maybe that's what's happening here. That was our starting hypothesis. Maybe once you start to inflate the cells, maybe you can't inflate all of them at once, and there's some kind of instability. Okay. So that's the question that we asked ourselves. Is there some kind of hydraulic, we call this a hydraulic instability, that might be at the heart of the cell death decision-making process in the gonad here? So there's two hypotheses we can, oppose. It could also be a cellular decision-making process. Of course, there's lots of signaling going on, and in the end, it's cell death genes that become activated. So maybe there's some kind of biological process that decides, or it's this mechanical one that I'm alluding to, illustrated by the balloons. Okay, so to answer that question, well, we first decided to proceed with quantifying as much as we can quantify. For example, the flows in this inner tube. Okay, remember, this is two tubes. There's an outer tube where there's all the germ cells on the outside, and there's the inner tube to which all the germ cells have a connection, have a hole. So we can just make movies of this large structure, and we can quantify flow fields using PIV. We know the radii. We know the radius along the gonad, so we can even infer the integrated fluxes. So we can measure how many femtoliters of cytoplasm flow past each point along the gonad per unit time. Okay, and when we quantify this, we get a graph that looks like this. So this is the flux in femtoliters per minute that goes past all these positions along the length. And what you can see is interesting. This flux increases, peaks, and then decreases again. Now, I guess you're all aware, if you have steady flow in a pipe, you know, Poisson flow in a pipe, you know, of course, the flux is constant. Okay, if there's no sources or sinks, the flux is constant. If the pipe gets thinner, the flow speeds up so that the flux is always the same. Okay, so here, the flux is not dedicated, is not constant. That means that prior to the peak, there's flows from the germ cells into the rachis, and after the peak, this flow inverts sign, and the flow now flows from the rachis into the germ cells. Okay? And this is great because it's a tube in a tube. There's nothing to discuss here. Okay? Where else should the fluid be coming from except from the outside? It must be coming from the germ cells, and it must be going into the germ cells after the peak. Okay? So we can, you know, together with Frank, there's a PhD student, Argo, shared PhD student between both of our labs, we've formalized the force balance along the gonad, both in for the germ cells and for the fluxes in the rachis. So we put forward balance equations for cell density. So again, at each position in time, cell density can only change by fluxes or birth-death processes. We can measure these birth-death processes because we can measure where in the embryo mitosis happens and where in the embryo cell death proceeds, which is exactly this zone. So we have all these fields available. We have, you know, and we, of course, you know, and this is a steady state situation. At any point in time, the gonad is a conveyor belt problem, but local quantities aren't really changing in time. So we can make use of steady state assumptions here to have to investigate both the balance equations for cell densities and for the fluxes of volume for the cells and for the rachis. And there's an exchange flux between rachis and germ cells that depends on the pressure difference between these two cells. Okay. This, together with a force balance equation, because both the germ cells move, and they'll have friction with respect to the outside and with respect to the rachis fluxes, and so this is friction with respect to the outside, this is the friction with respect to the rachis, this difference in velocity between the rachis flux and the germ cells gives rise, again, to a dissipative force, which is balanced by this gradient and pressure here. So this is essentially a fully determined systems. Once we know, and that's the most important thing, the source flux from the outside, the material must be coming from somewhere. I told you that the flow in the rachis speeds up and then decays. As it speeds up, the volume comes from the cells. We can measure how the cells flow, and we can measure how the cells change volume. But you know, these cells are growing. They're still dumping, at the same time, they're dumping cytosol into the rachis, which means that they must be getting fluid from the outside. Okay? So by determining all these flow fields and making the steady state assumption, we can infer the source flux of material from the outside into the germ cells. Okay? And this is what we've done here. First, to tell you that we can infer the velocity field of the cells, we can kind of see it here. This is a highly sped up movie, but you can see it's very hard to measure very slow velocities even over long times because we have to follow individual cells. Over here, close to the term region, we can do this, but we can make the steady state assumption and infer the flow field from the birth and death processes, which we can independently measure. Okay, so this is the fully inferred flow field. Here is actual measured flow field in a particular zone where the speeds are fast enough. So this matches up. Okay, so with this and with the rachis flux, we can infer the flux, source flux we call this, from the outside into the germ cells. Okay, and this is interesting because this source flux grows and then drops to zero. And it drops to zero right about where the flow in the rachis peaks, where the flux from germ cells to rachis inverts, okay, and the germ cells become inflated. So really, this whole system is probably controlled by the source flux. Okay. All right, so with this 1D, simple 1D theory, we can then with the source flux, infer the, for example, the volumetric flux in the Rakes, and you know, it seems to be consistent with the data. We can also infer in two different ways the pressure difference between the germ cells and the Rakes. Remember, the flux from the germ cells to the Rakes changes sign at about 60% length when the flux inverts. Of course, you know, the flux inverts precisely because there's a pressure inversion between germ cells and Rakes. Prior to this pressure inversion point, the pressure is higher in the germ cells than in the Rakes, so they're pumping fluid out. After this inversion, the pressure is higher in the Rakes than in the germ cells, and the flux now goes into the Rakes. Okay? And now, and here I'm going to just, now we can build a couple of different models that capture this effect here. It's an elastic effect. We can capture that with a Laplace-like effect with constant surface tension. And we can capture it in other ways. But in essence, we can build a model where the volume of germ cells is stabilized by the influxes. And when the influxes cease and the pressure difference between germ cell and Rakes inverts, this switches to a boundary stable problem where they are coupled, some germ cells will grow to their maximum volume and some will shrink to a minimal volume. So at some point, a germ size volume is no longer defined, and the germ cells then go either way, either grow or shrink. Okay. So again, this captures exactly this. And there's one more thing I want to do tell you, because this is actually a switch. Okay. So one more experiment. So I can squeeze it, and either there's a dramatic effect and this blows up, or I can squeeze it over. Come on, here we go, okay? And now the others, so this is a switch-like, so I can switch it between either one or the other. Okay, I just wanted to show you this, because I brought it along from Germany, god damn it. Okay, so this is really boundary-stable volume, switch-like behavior, okay? So, okay, so this makes a couple of predictions, if this is all correct. First of all, pressure should invert exactly when the germ cells start to grow and shrink. So prior to this pressure inversion, there's homogeneous growth. After the pressure inversion, there's heterogeneous growth. Some grow, some shrink. And that should, you know, that should be correlated with the position where the position where the germ cells start to vary in size should be somehow correlated with the point of pressure inversion and flux maximum in the Rakes. So we looked at that. So here are the volumes of the germ cells. I've showed you this graph before. Of course, now it's a bit tricky to figure out where does this, so this is a single distribution, and at some point this distribution splits into two. There's many ways to assess unimodality or bimodality. One way that works, and I'm going to illustrate on the next slide, is we just look at different bins along this position axis, and we plot the mean in germ cell volume versus the variance in germ cell volume for each bin. If it's unimodal, you typically have a relationship between mean and standard deviation, maybe it's proportional. But if it becomes bimodal, we expect it's no longer unimodal, and a variance is no longer an appropriate description, perhaps, since it's bimodal. So we expect the variance to grow quicker than the mean. Okay, and that's precisely what we see when we plot mean volumes versus the variance. And so we see, you know, two different regimes. You know, a slow growth and a fast growth. And that crossover point we can identify back here is approximately here, and it's just after the fluxes peak. Okay, so that makes us happy. So precisely when the flux inverts, when the pressure inverts, you know, just a little bit later, the germ cells start to vary in size, and the distribution becomes bimodal and growth becomes heterogeneous. Okay. So pressure inverts just before germ cells begin to vary in size. All right, so that's some indication that we might have a switch from homogeneous to heterogeneous growth. But is it proof? Well, you know, can we perform another experiment that adds a bit more credence to this hypothesis that it's actually a hydraulic instability? Well, another thing we can do is we can turn off the cell decision-making machinery. Okay, so that makes a very precise prediction, because if we turn off, if this splitting was driven by some cell decision-making process over here, and then the ones that are fated to die become small, if I turned off the cell decision-making machinery, you should no longer see small cells. They should all become large. Whereas if it's a hydraulic instability that makes the decision, we should still see large and small cells, except now there's no more apoptosis and the small cells should still survive. They shouldn't be eaten up. Okay? So that makes a very precise prediction because we turn off the cell death pathway. Question is, do we lose this branch or do we still keep it? Okay, and we perform the experiment. In fact, it was in the original publications, in the second publication with this gene CellDev3, where it was already reported in the that this this RNAi, this removal of this gene gives rise to large and small eggs. Okay, so what we see here is we still have this branch. There's, the gonad becomes a bit longer. Interesting things happen. This point moves a little bit back, this splitting point, but we still see splitting. We see large cells, we see small cells, except now all of the cells survive. Okay, so that, and again, here we have this splitting. Here's a little bit further behind the peak in the volumetric flux in the rachis. Okay, so this is the point of pressure inversion, and just a bit behind we have the splitting up of the distributions. Okay, so in both conditions, pressure inverts just before the germ size volumes are no longer unimodal. And this also, again, lends credence to the idea that it's really a mechanical mechanism that's at the heart of cell death decision in the C. elegans gonad. Okay, so maybe it is a hydraulic instability. Just as a point which is interesting, we can now plot the volumes of the cells, again, on the same graph. You see this kind of collapses quite nicely, and it just tells us that cells can grow on their own until about 100, 150 femtoliters, and beyond 150, they need to be pumped. Okay, because so basically, cells grow until 150 on their own, and to grow cells larger, in this system at least, than 150 femtoliters, you need to have pressure inversion and pumping. All right, so this is all compatible with this statement here, which is that this life and death decision in the gonad is basically a mechanical one. Okay? Hydraulic instability triggered by pressure inversion. Of course, now if that's true, we should be able to bias the outcome of this decision with a mechanical perturbation. Okay? And the question that we set ourselves to do is, can we test this? And we used the following tool, which was developed by the lab of Moritz Kreising in Dresden at the Max Planck, where we use the following technique, which is called thermoviscous pumping. Okay, and what this microscope does is it takes an infrared laser beam, heats up water, and then moves this laser beam in a particular pattern. Water, when it gets heated, expands. So if you move a heating laser a little bit, if you move it over to a point in front of a spot you've just heated, as this volume expands, it sees cold water in front and hot water behind. The hot water is more fluid, so this is going to expand uniaxially. So with specific heating patterns, you can drive flows. And this is quite remarkable. This is a C. elegans embryo. Now we're looking at the middle of a C. elegans embryo, and you can see these flows as per magic. Okay, this is a slide from Moritz, huh? Some magical wand driving flows inside. So you see dramatic flows. This is only sped up 10 times that are driven by thermoviscous pumping. So we thought, with this technique, can we now bias the outcome? Can we, for example, pump cells empty? And if we do so, are they more likely to die? Okay, so that's what we set out to do. So the question was, we take individual germ cells, at a stage prior to this apoptotic zone. We then pursue thermoviscous pumping along this through the hole, pump out some cytosol. They should grow. They should shrink. Do they now die? Okay. Of course, it's a bit of a tricky experiment because you're heating the cells with a laser. So as a control, we provided the same laser dose, but instead of pumping unidirectionally, we would pump back and forth very quickly with no net flux, but the same type of heating, if the heating might be killing the cells or not. Okay. So. And then the question is, does this increase the likelihood of dying if we now perturb them in this way? Okay. So here you can see the experiment. It's very tricky. It took us several months, took Julia several months to find the right conditions to make this work. So we pursue this flux experiment for about 15 minutes, and then we wait 3 hours to assay whether that particular germ cell rounds up and dies or whether it continues to survive. Okay. So this cell you can see, you can't see the flux, but I hope you can see a little bit how these particles are flowing out in response to the flux. And now the laser is turned off. We follow the cell for 3 hours, and this cell is now rounded up and has lots of myosin on its surface, so that's the perfect indication that the cell will die. Okay? So this cell, in response to flux, has died. All right, so now we have to compare the control experiment, which is the back and forth experiment. Under the back and forth experiment, we have about 15% of the cells undergoing apoptosis. And I told you before, so undergoing apoptosis within 3 hours that this experiment takes. I told you before that half of the cells undergo apoptosis. So in 3 hours, that corresponds with the flows of the cells, that corresponds to round about exactly somewhere between 15 and 20% of cells in a 3-hour window in that zone will undergo apoptosis. So that's basically the basal rate that we expect. Now, if we do the flux, we can increase the likelihood of cells to die to above 50%. So with pumping out, 50%, 56% of the cells die. And if we now look at, even correlate, for the individual cells with which we perform flux, we can look at whether they shrink in volume. And for those that shrink in volume, that actually where the flux is successful, 90% of those cells will die. Okay, so I'm not showing those numbers here. So I think that is a good indication that indeed this cell fate decision process is determined in a mechanical way by this hydraulic instability, by using the inability to simultaneously inflate germ cells as a means to have some cells grow and some cells shrink. Okay? And of course, the big outstanding question now is, and we don't have an answer for that, is how size is actually measured, because it means that you first make large and small cells, and then you selectively remove the small ones, and you somehow have to measure size, or something related to size, we don't know. Okay? So that's ongoing work at the moment. All right, that's my first take-home message. Hydraulic instability is used to select which germ cells are destined to die in the C. elegans gonad. Okay. All right, I still have a little bit of time, huh? 10 more minutes. So let's switch topics, and I'll be quick.
10 minutes and counting.
Wow, that's remarkable. Okay, now my watch will... Wow, how did that happen? Okay, Jesus. Okay. It's listening to me. That's scary. Jesus. Okay, so 10 minutes. Okay. Trivolume gastrulation. This is a project we've been pursuing with the Tomanchak lab. This is concerned with gastrulation and with gastrulation movements. So with large-scale tissue movements that cause the inversion of a tissue to make 3 germ layers. Okay, and all we've been interested in, I'm just going to keep it very simple, is this movement, which in Drosophila, so these are both insects, they behave quite similarly in many aspects. They have the similar genes that give rise to the patterning. The type of gastrulatory movements are a little bit different. In Tribolium, you have an extra embryonic and an embryonic tissue, and this is already marked by cell fate markers. I colored this myself, but we have transgenic lines, or Pavel's lab has transgenic lines that can label these tissues accordingly. And what happens over gastrulation is that the inner tissue inverts and the outer tissue expands. So the green tissue, just to play that again, the green tissue becomes the actual embryo. It's called embryonic, while the red tissue covers the whole system and is the extra embryonic tissue, shed at a later time. Okay? So we were intrigued by this movement, in particular because it's a very asymmetric movement. Okay? And if you think about force balances driving movements and contractile force generation driving flows, much like the contractile forces in actomyosin to drive actomyosin flows inside a single cell, you typically get, you know, symmetric types of movements, contractions towards a certain movements towards a certain point, but not uniaxial movements. So this is again driven by the same myosin that I showed you at the very beginning of the talk. It's not in a single cell, but it's in a supracellular structure. All the cells are connected. All these cells have an apical surface with lots of myosin. Each of these cells wants to contract, generates a contractile stress, and then some cells contract more than others, generate an increased amount of contractile stress, and that'll drive flows. Okay? So this is not a syncytium. Each one of these cells is closed, but these cells sit around a basically incompressible yolk sac, okay? And they're protected on the outside with a vitellin membrane, with a vitellin embryo that's that's basically attached to a rather rigid shell that surrounds the whole system. Okay, and that'll become important in a minute. So myosin activity in a couple of these cells drive these flows. We chose to analyze this now in a mid-plane, it's called a sagittal cut. So of course this is very complex dynamics on a 3D surface, but we thought much of this is represented if we just look at this cut, this so-called sagittal cut through the middle. And what you can see here is that all of these cells, they start to move over. This region somehow contracts, you know, moves over, there's this inversion fold. So here we see these are the flow speeds. You see basically backtracked flow lines. So you see how this tissue converges somewhere over here, okay? Converges to this point. So we thought, well, again, this is just actinomycin contracting. It's an active material. You know, ATP consumption by myosin drives forces. These cells are connected, so forces are transmitted across the connections. We should be able to take these simple descriptions and predict the flow field from the myosin distribution. So what you're seeing here, in fact, in blue, is the myosin distribution. Can we predict the flow field, this 1D flow field, from this particular myosin distribution at each point along time, along the circumference? So we set out to do this. This is the measurement. So this is, for one point in time, the flow field. You see all the flow values are positive, which means it's unidirectional, which is the thing that got us excited at the start. Whereas when we take this myosin distribution and there's a friction coefficient we have to determine, it's rather low, so the hydrodynamic length is rather large. So whatever we do, we get symmetric flow fields. And that's quite natural because this is connected to the outside by a friction coefficient. If the friction coefficient is homogeneous and not isotropic, it's like you contracting in free space. You're not going to move anywhere. Okay? There's no net force exerted by the surrounding if the friction coefficient is homogeneous. So so that's a little bit of a, you know, that's not consistent with what we see. So we started to look a little bit more closely, and in particular, we started to look at this particular zone over here, which, if I show you this movie, you can just see it. It just doesn't move, okay? You see this closure, and there's some kind of interesting rip-off mechanism happening here. So we thought, well, maybe there's something here that's attaching the tissue to the outside. And such attachments have been, have been found in other systems, but they've rarely been are deemed to be important for morphogenetic processes. Okay, so we were quite excited about that possibility, that there's some selective sticking point over here. So we investigated that zone. First, if we take this this description with the same physical parameters, same myosin distribution, and we introduce an inhomogeneous friction coefficient with one point where friction is very large, and then the other zone friction, again, is very low. So basically, this generates a net force and causes unidirectional movements. Okay, so now the tissue contracts. This region is fixed, so there's a large friction. So this will generate whatever force it needs to generate in order to keep the point fixed. So this will generate a counterforce. This will give rise to asymmetric movements. And these, in fact, match the experimental results quite well. Okay. So we went on looking for something that might be attaching the extra-embryonic tissue to the vitellin in that region. So first we looked, and this is Stefan Münster, first we looked in EM, and we saw that some cells really are very closely attached to the vitellin, maybe indicative of an attachment. You can even see this when you look at the dynamics of these cells in this zone. You see that some really touch down, maybe attached, okay? We can then do an experiment where we add trypsin, which is like a molecular scissor, into the extra-embryonic fluid, only outside. And that would eat up any such connections. And when we do this, this is colored in pink, this dye, you see that all of a sudden you get symmetric movements, you get a response. Okay? So this might be severing this type of attachment. But most importantly, this is, again, in collaboration with Pavel's lab, and Pavel has been working on Drosophila and also Tribolium gene expression patterns. And this is a study from the Roth lab where they've just looked at all kinds of genes that have proteins that have, so this is gene products that have particular locations inside an embryo. And they found one that has exactly the right distribution to be perhaps anchoring at this site. And this is, in fact, an integrin. So integrins are proteins that mediate contacts from, you know, between cells and even from cells to outsides. So we were quite excited about that because here's a specific integrin that has exactly the right expression pattern that might be driving selectively this attachment. So when we then knock it out by RNAi, this is what we see. We see symmetric movements. Okay, and in fact, this moves freely, can start even starts to spin around. But most importantly, the flow fields that we measure, they are perfectly compatible with the original ones that we had predicted without the anchorage. Okay, all right, that's it. So take-home message two: a specific attachment off the blastoderm to the vitellin generates a counterforce important for gastrulation in the system. And this is really a mechanical anchor that guides the patterning process. There's intra-tissue self-organization, but there's a specific anchor that guides the shape and the types of movements that are generated. And last take-home message, this is all about active metaphysics. I think this is, you know, for the first time, we now have a framework. Thanks to people like Jean-François Joanny, we have a framework where we can, you know, consider force balances in biological matter, consider interactions between signaling pathways and force generation processes to investigate how, you know, systems break symmetries and organize, self-organize during development. And with that, I'll stop. Thank all the people that I had the great luck to work with over the past years, and here in particular, Argo, Julia, and Nick, for the Gonad project, and Stefan Minster, and Vijay, and Alex Mietke, I forgot to color label, for the Tribolium project.